This podcast contains content that may not be suitable for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Be sure to head over to thecrimeshack.com for all available episodes, merchandise, and show notes, and subscribe to us for free wherever you get your podcasts. As you know, it takes a lot of research and time to keep this podcast going, and you can help this show by purchasing merchandise, joining my Patreon, or just by buying me a coffee. My podcast is currently sponsorless, and any support from my listeners is much appreciated.
There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the ASA.
My gosh.
They're all going against the wind. The wind's 120 knots from the west. The whole thing, dude.
Who would have thought that in 2021, the Pentagon would release an unclassified report that proved the existence of aliens? Well, that didn't really happen. I mean, they released the reports, but the reports pretty much state, we have absolutely no idea what those flying objects are in the sky. And they make zero mention of extraterrestrial life. You know the funny thing about that? With all that was going on in 2020, and we were told that the Pentagon was going to release these documents on alien existence, I don't think it fazed anyone. I think having aliens infiltrate the Earth was the least of our worries, and honestly, no one was surprised or shocked. But let's get real. Do we know if aliens exist or not? Well, there's a group of people who wholeheartedly do believe in aliens. They also believe that the Earth is flat, as well as a number of other conspiracy theories. If you believe in those things, great. You can choose to believe whatever you want to believe in, whatever brings you joy. But here's where that line gets a little blurred. When the belief system of someone causes harm to another individual, even causes death. In this episode, I'll be talking about murder, but oddly, that won't be the most shocking thing about this case. So stick around as it's about to get real weird up in here. Armand Chavez was born in Houston, Texas on March 5, 1965. Armand was a career con artist. Although he claimed to be a thoracic surgeon who held degrees from the University of Tokyo and Cornell Medical College, he had doctored his transcripts and had been expelled from medical school. After he was expelled, Armand changed his name to the aggrandized Diazin Hasenkopf. In 1992. Along with claiming to be a thoracic surgeon, he also said he was a former CIA scientist. Diazin tricked patients into believing he was a geneticist and told people that he had leukemia and had only 5 months to live. He would tell neighbors that he planned a visit to Toronto, Ontario, Canada, or El Paso, Texas, for medical treatments. A significant portion of his income was made from treating cancer patients, bilking over $100,000 from them by selling what they thought was a miracle cure for cancer, but was actually just vitamin B6. He also claimed he was several thousand years old and had invented anti-aging injections. During the 1990s, Diazin made a trip to SeaWorld in San Antonio, Texas, where he met a lovely woman named Girly Chu. Girly was born in Malaysia in August of 1963 and had been on a trip to the States when she met the charming Diazin. When Girly returned to Malaysia, the two began to write each other letters and their relationship grew at an extremely fast pace. Within a week of meeting each other at SeaWorld, Girly moved to the United States to be with Diazin. The couple married in 1993 and moved to the 3900 block of Moon Street in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where Gurley began work as a bank teller at the National Bank of the United States in Albuquerque. Diazin continued with his fraudulent persona, ultimately catching the attention of the FBI. In 1995, he attempted to purchase a bioreactor from a Philadelphia, Pennsylvania company under the guise of conducting cell growth experiments. The company was leery about selling the device to Diazin because of its potential uses, so they notified the FBI about the purchaser, but Diazin wasn't arrested. As if being a fraud wasn't bad enough, Diazin began seeking out other women and began having affairs on Gurley. In 1996, during one of those affairs, he fathered a son, Dimitri, with a Japanese woman living in Canada. Diazin brought the child to New Mexico, telling Gurley that he was a Mexican orphan and that they had to adopt him. Gurley was initially leery about the whole situation, but soon became accustomed to being a mother and came to love Dimitri. It would be almost 2 years later that Gurley would discover the horrible truth, that Diazin was the biological father of the child. In the summer of 1998, Diazin met 50-year-old Julie K. McGuire, the owner of the Enchantment Lodge in Aztec, New Mexico. He met her through an internet dating service where he introduced himself as a doctor and an expert geneticist. The two became romantically involved, Julie not having any idea that Diazin was still married, and he convinced Julie he could take years off her life, and she paid him more than $6,000 for 2 injections of this youth serum. She started to get leery of Diazin and had the serum tested only to discover it was actually vitamin B12. It's pretty apparent that Gurley and Diazin's relationship was quickly deteriorating. In addition to his lies, Diazin's behavior towards Gurley became more erratic and violent. In 1998, during an argument, Diazin choked and threatened to kill Gurley. She called police and when they arrived, told them that Diazin became angry when she confronted his previous girlfriend, and the woman decided to break it off with Diazin. It was in January of 1999, shortly following the domestic violence incident, that Gurley moved out of their shared home. Diazin pushed for full custody of Dimitri, and reluctantly Gurley agreed and allowed the child to stay with him. She moved into an apartment at 8401 Spain Road Northeast in Albuquerque, hired an attorney, and filed for divorce. Diazin was not only angered that Gurley had the gall to ask for a divorce, but she also was asking for some of their things. This enraged him, and he called her at work, telling her that she wouldn't see a single dime of his money and that she'll die and her body will never be found. Through the divorce process, Gurley discovered that Diazin was in fact not a doctor at all and had been using a fake name. After discovering this information, along with his violent threats, Gurley confided in her coworkers, telling them that Diazin was threatening her and that she was afraid of him. She told them to contact authorities if she was even 5 minutes late to work, saying, quote, "If I don't show up, it means Diazin has done something to me." Gurley had already suspected Diazin of smashing her car windows on 2 separate occasions after she had moved out of their house. Gurley was so afraid of Diazin and what he might do to her that she even contacted the FBI, who had already been investigating him, telling them that she was afraid of him and that he had threatened to kill her on more than 1 occasion. Gurley did everything she could to warn others of Diazin's violent behavior and to protect herself. She even began taking karate lessons for self-defense. Diazin was still seeing Julie McGuire and would often bring Dimitri with him, causing Julie to become quite attached to the three-year-old child. Julie knew about Dyson's troubles with his ex-wife, Girlie. He confided in her that he was going to pay someone to kill Girlie and that no one would find the body. She told Dyson that bodies are usually discovered sooner than later, and Dyson responded by saying, "Not if they're dissected." Julie began to feel sorry for Dimitri and had an inkling that Dyson was abusing the boy, so she felt the need to protect the child. She believed Dyson's horror stories about Girlie and offered to help him find a family that could adopt Dimitri. They attempted to place the child with a couple, but after the first day the couple had Dimitri, they returned the child as he became violent with their other child. Dyson attempted to adopt out Dimitri again, and this time it was permanent, and Dimitri was adopted in September of 1999 to Melinda Miles Lindbergh, an attorney out of Anchorage, Alaska. Melinda actually wrote a book about her experience adopting Dimitri, titled Mommy Number 13, A Child of a Murderer and His Adoptive Mother. In her book, she describes how more than a dozen women tried to mother Dimitri in his first 3 years, including Girlie Chu. Melinda was the 13th woman, thus the title of the book. She went on to describe the little boy, saying that although he was rambunctious and bright, he showed little affection, connection, or trust for others. His years being tossed from one caregiver to another obviously had taken its toll. Although Melinda raised the boy, he became estranged from her in 2015 when he turned 18. He only responded to her one time on social media, giving her a negative response to her book, calling it syrupy. Dimitri, which he has since changed his name, is now 23 years old and hasn't seen Melinda in over 5 years. Dyson's relationship with Julie McGuire eventually waned as Dyson's behavior became stranger and stranger. Julie also discovered that Dyson was not who he said he was, finding out that he was still married and that he had a domestic violence charge against him. Julie last saw Dyson in August of 1999. But Dyson's philandering continued, and in the summer of 1999, he met another person who would soon become his fiance. That woman was Linda Henning. Linda Henning was born in Hollywood, California on October 10, 1953. When Linda was 11 years old, her father left her mother, which left Linda with some deep emotional scars. She tried to mend these scars by involving herself in relationship after relationship, pushing her emotional needs onto various men. Author Mark Horner of the book September Sacrifice about Girlie's disappearance wrote in his book about Linda, writing that this is a person who, according to her own mother, would believe the moon was made out of cheese if a boy had said it. After Linda completed high school, she supported herself working as a fashion model and later began designing women's apparel. Her clothing line took off, and in the 80s, Linda moved to Albuquerque, New Mexico. By the 90s, Linda's business was booming. She owned a beautiful home, enjoyed Southwestern art, and was engaged to be married. Aside from her entrepreneurship, she also had a keen interest in UFOs and conspiracy theories. Not surprising, since the UFO hotspot Roswell, the city in southeastern New Mexico that is renowned as the site of an alleged 1947 UFO crash, was only about 3 hours away, and Area 51 was about 800 miles from Albuquerque. As a teenager, Linda had done a lot of research about government conspiracies and was obsessed with shows like The X-Files. In the summer of 1999, Linda attended a seminar by English conspiracy theorist David Icke. Icke believes that the world has been hijacked by an unseen global network called Archons that are interdimensional, pedophilic, shape-shifting reptilians that are made up of the world's ruling elite, such as George Soros or the British royal family. This global network is responsible for manipulating the world's events and keeping humans in a constant state of fear so that the Archons can feed off the resulting negative energy. Let's listen to Linda explaining her beliefs and who exactly owns planet Earth.
I believe that there is an incredibly strong alien presence on this planet. I also believe they've been here long before humans were here. And I believe that they have an agenda of eradicating the human presence on this planet. Who owns this planet? Well, I'm going to tell you that humanity does not. These creatures have been here way before mankind was ever thought of. Who owns this planet? Well, you're going to find out real soon.
Linda also believed that the government leaders were aliens from another planet. It was around this time that Linda was told about Diazin Hasenkopf by the owner of the gym she worked out in. He told her that she might want to meet this guy, that he had a lot of interesting ideas, and gave her Diazin's card. Linda met Diazin at his home, and the two talked for hours, sharing their ideas and theories about aliens and other conspiracy theories. Diazin told Linda that he was a doctor and a former member of the CIA. He also told her that he was an alien and was immortal. Diazin claimed to Linda and others to be from the Giga Planet, and that he was thousands of years old, and that he was able to morph into different reptiles. Linda was fascinated by Diazin and the knowledge he had amassed, and within a week of their meeting, their relationship intensified. Within weeks of meeting Diazin, her personality seemed to change. She was already fascinated by the unusual, and when Diazin came into her life, it accelerated her strange beliefs. Diazin didn't talk much, however, about his soon-to-be ex-wife Girlie Chu, only that she worked as a bank teller. 2 weeks after meeting Diazin, Linda broke off her engagement with her fiancé and began an intense relationship with Diazin, telling her friends that they were planning to get married. Linda talked about her and Diazin's relationship in this interview.
Diazin does not control me or dominate me, and nobody does. Whoever can control an opinionated woman, a strong-willed woman, an independent woman? He's brilliant, he's charming. Diazin is a maniac. He's a maniac.
As a result of the relationship, Linda's friends began to notice the significant change in her behavior. Her ex-fiancé told a mutual friend, Stephen Zachary, that Linda had stopped showering and wouldn't change her clothes, and that he thought she had some sort of chemical imbalance. Linda would try to convince her friends to use Diazin's miracle treatments and told them that he was a reptilian alien who was thousands of years old, who had promised to give her great powers. She believed that the reptile aliens were going to be coming to Earth, and certain individuals would be their local emissaries. Diazin convinced her that she was an alien queen who was sent here to save the world by killing Girlie. A man by the name of William Bill Miller, a leader of a militant group in Albuquerque, was also befriended by Diazin. Diazin worked on coaching both Linda and Bill on how to kill the Queen to save the world. And the Queen, apparently, was Girlie Chu. It was 5:15 p.m. on September 9, 1999, when Girlie's shift ended at the bank and she left work. She mailed a letter to her parents in Malaysia between 5:40 and 5:45 p.m. and then headed to her apartment. Between 7:30 p.m. and 9 p.m., a friend called Girlie's home phone 10 times, but she never picked up. The following morning, Girlie failed to show up for work for her 8 a.m. shift and didn't call in to say that she wasn't coming in. Girlie was a model employee, always punctual, always the first one to work, so her not showing up for work on time was extremely unusual. Her coworkers immediately became concerned, recalling their discussion with her about her being scared of her ex-husband. Her supervisor contacted the Albuquerque Police Department and reported her missing at 8:10 a.m., stressing to them that her absence was highly unusual and that she'd met with foul play. Police actually took the missing person's report seriously in lieu of waiting the normal 24 hours or so when an adult goes missing. One of Gurley's coworkers decided to drive to Gurley's apartment but found no sign of Gurley. While waiting for officers to arrive, the coworker convinced the apartment manager to check inside Gurley's apartment. They noticed that her front door was locked, but the deadbolt wasn't locked. A quick view of the apartment showed nothing seemingly out of place. When the police arrived at Gurley's apartment, the first thing they noticed was the intense smell of bleach permeating the air. Gurley's car keys were still in the apartment, but there were three distinct bleached-out stains in the carpet in front of her couch. When forensics arrived later to the scene, Luminol was sprayed in the house, and they discovered about 7 spots of blood on the carpet and sofa. The carpet that was stained with bleach was cut out and was taken to the crime lab for testing. Later that same day, a workman who was working along Highway 60, a stretch of highway about 100 miles southwest of Albuquerque, came across a blood-stained gray tarp containing a woman's green and white blouse, pink and orange shorts, and green panties, all splattered with blood. There was also some duct tape and gauze containing strands of hair in the tarp. Gurley's purse was found discarded on a nearby street. Authorities awaited the results of this evidence along with the blood evidence they recovered from Gurley's apartment. An extensive search for Gurley Chu began. Search parties were coordinated, searching mine shafts and searching the area where her clothes were found. Search and rescue dogs were utilized, but no sign of Gurley was found. Authorities quickly set their sights on Dyson Hasenkopf, considering him a prime suspect. They went to his house, but found his front door open, and his house had been emptied of all furniture and belongings. Police found out that Dyson had hired a moving company and that he left Albuquerque on September 10th for Charleston, South Carolina. His neighbors told authorities that they had noticed Dyson spending a great deal of time with Linda Henning the week prior to Gurley's disappearance. Authorities then headed to Linda Henning's house. She allowed the officers in without a search warrant, answered their questions, and told them she knew nothing of Gurley's disappearance. Officers then found Gurley's wallet. It had been discarded in the street near Tramway Boulevard and Indian School Road Northeast, about 6 miles from Gurley's apartment and about half a mile from Linda Henning's house. The proximity to Linda's house was too much of a coincidence for the officers to ignore. They brought Linda back into the station for further questioning on September 12th. She told detectives what she knew about Dyson, that she believed him to be an accomplished doctor, and that she didn't know where he was and didn't expect to see him again. She said that he told her he'd been planning to move for some time, and that he was building a house in South Carolina. She also told them that her relationship with Dyson was more of a caretaker role, and that they weren't romantically involved. It didn't take long for authorities to track down Dyson at a house in Charleston where he was staying with a woman named Cheryl Culp. Similar to Linda, Dyson had begun a relationship with Cheryl, and she believed that she and Dyson were going to be married. Dyson denied knowing anything about Gurley's whereabouts, and authorities had no evidence to hold him in custody, so they had to let him go. However, when authorities got back to New Mexico, they found out that Dyson had made a phone call to one of his neighbors, a phone call that the neighbor deemed threatening. That was the break that authorities needed, and they were able to extradite Diazin back to New Mexico to face charges for making threats across state lines. Believing that Linda was somehow involved in Gurley's disappearance and that she knew more than what she was letting on, authorities subpoenaed her to testify before a grand jury. She claimed that she didn't even know Gurley Chu and hadn't met her. She told them Diazin had been with her the night before Gurley went missing and admitted that her and Diazin were more than just friends. She also said that she was aware that Diazin was moving to South Carolina to be with another woman. One of the grand jurors, who frankly was thinking the same thing that we're all thinking, asked her how she could sleep with Diazin the night before, knowing that he was leaving the next day to be with another woman. Linda said, yeah, she was upset, but couldn't do anything about it. Unfortunately, Linda's grand jury testimony didn't lead to indictments for either Linda or Diazin, but police weren't through with the investigation. They pulled bank records and were able to prove that Linda did in fact meet Gurley and that she lied to the grand jury. Linda had banked at the branch where Gurley worked, and Gurley had even been Linda's teller on at least one occasion. In October of 1999, Linda was charged with perjury for lying to the grand jury. When investigators received the test results back on the evidence found at Gurley's apartment, as well as the evidence found by the highway worker, they were surprised at the results. Blood and hair on the items belonged to Gurley, but two other individuals' DNA was also identified. Gurley's blood was on the carpet and sofa, but Linda's blood was also identified. Saliva that was on Gurley's green and white blouse was identified as being from Diazin. Glitter, art sand, and cat hair, all identified as originating from Linda's garage floor, were found on the tarp as well. A third unidentified source of DNA was also found in the blood in Gurley's apartment. Authorities believed that a struggle occurred in the apartment and that Linda most likely had been injured, resulting in her blood being found at the scene. During a search of Linda's home, authorities recovered a ninja sword in her garage ceiling attic. Receipts showed that on September 9th, between 3:59 and 7:35 p.m., Diazin purchased the sword at World of Knives at Winrock Center in Albuquerque and had given Linda the sword as a gift to learn fencing. Supposedly, according to Linda, the sword had been in plain sight the first time officers questioned her at her house. The sword was confiscated for forensic testing, but the test results were inconclusive. There was blood on it, but it had been compromised, and they couldn't lift good DNA from it. In November 1999, 34-year-old Diazin Hasenkopf and 46-year-old Linda Henning were indicted for the disappearance and assumed murder of 36-year-old Gurley Chu Hasenkopf. A third individual, 52-year-old William Bill Miller, an alleged co-conspirator, was also indicted. Diazin originally pled not guilty to the charges, but on January 14, 2002, he surprised prosecutors and changed his plea and pled guilty to the murder of Gurley Chu in an effort to avoid the death penalty. He was sentenced and in exchange for his plea received life in prison plus 61 years in the Wyoming State Penitentiary. He continued to deny killing Gurley or knowing the location of her remains. Linda's trial began in September 2002. Attorneys Gary Mitchin and Monica Baca claimed that Linda was innocent of all charges and that Diazin was trying to frame Linda for Gurley's murder. Diazin was the only witness called to testify in Linda's defense. The first day of her trial, Linda seemed to be in a joking mood answering a reporter's question about how she felt about finally heading into trial.
Tell me that again, please.
I've just waited 3 years to go to trial, and now I have my chance. And I was tired of being tried by the press. And now it's time for us to fight back. That's what a trial is all about.
Anything about aliens in all of this?
Oh, I'm sure there'll be an alien or two on the witness stand.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Well, we'll try to keep the aliens out of the jurors.
Okay.
To say Dyson's testimony on the stand was bizarre is an understatement. He thought that by putting a show on the stand, it would confuse the jury and help get Linda a not guilty verdict. Dyson claimed that he was the mastermind behind the murder of Gurley, and that Linda didn't take part in it, had no knowledge of the murder, and was completely innocent. He also claimed to be a reptilian shapeshifter and was capable of being in several places at one time. So yeah, there's that. During the trial, witnesses testified that around 7 p.m. on September 9th, the last time Gurley was seen, Dyson was seen by his neighbors speeding into his driveway on 3900 Moon Northeast Street. Neighbors noticed that his face and neck were covered in black grease paint, and he appeared to be wearing a forest green or a camouflage type shirt. He was seen going into his house for a few minutes and then leaving shortly afterwards. Dyson testified that around 10 p.m. on September 9th, he asked Linda to pick up juice, a flashlight, and tile spacers so he could buy time to go back to Gurley's apartment to bleach the blood stains and clean up other evidence at the apartment. He then drove back home and located a refrigerated vial of an unidentified woman's blood. He was somehow able to occasionally obtain blood samples from patients under the guise of scientific research, and there were allegedly 17 vials of blood in his home. When Dyson went back to Gurley's apartment, the vial broke. Don't you hate it when that happens? Before he was able to pour it somewhere in the apartment in an effort to confuse detectives. Instead of the vial, he thought it was a good idea to go ahead and use Linda's blood, and he diluted it with bleach in an attempt to invalidate DNA results and again to confuse the investigation. Dyson talked about how Gurley Chu purportedly took his son away from him, which of course wasn't true, and that was his reasoning why she had to die. He stated, "So they make the choice. They took my son from me, and I make the choice to take her life. It's as simple as that." And when asked if Gurley knew that Dyson was going to harm her, this is what he said in court. And as a forewarning, his voice is quite possibly the most annoying voice you will ever hear.
She knew that you were looking for her.
She knew she was going to be hunted like the dog she was. And yes, she knew, like a scared rabbit in an open field, she knew.
Dyson pointed a finger at another individual, militia member William Bill Miller, and that he was Gurley's true killer. Bill was friends with both Dyson and Linda, and Dyson admitted to Bill to wanting Gurley dead due to a bitter custody battle. Dyson said he allowed Bill to murder Gurley as practice before the climax with the alien New World Order. Bill Miller had not been charged with Gurley's murder, as there was no evidence that he himself had murdered anyone. Linda's friends believe that she had been brainwashed and drugged by Dyson, and forensic investigators testified for the prosecution about Linda's odd actions the days leading up to the murder. Prior to meeting Dyson, Linda had never been in trouble with the law. One of Linda's friends, Mary Alice Thomas, testified during the trial about the odd things that Linda told her.
Did the defendant make statements to you about being a queen?
She said that she had been appointed a queen of the world and that her responsibilities was to save the world from other queens coming from other planets.
And did she say with what she would be fighting these other queens?
With a sword.
The trial of Linda Henning only got stranger and stranger as it progressed. When prosecutor Paul Spears asked Ron Wilkin, the lead detective on the case, to describe what Linda said about her and Dyson's lovemaking, he said, quote, "She made reference to where there was a very high amount of energy, enough to where they would each transform into cat-like people or like a lion type of an individual, and she went so far as to lift her lip up to show me where the fangs would grow out of her mouth." I really need to take some of these statements from her trial and, I don't know, put them on t-shirts or something. Essentially, the prosecution had the records that showed Linda had come into contact with Gurley at the bank, and they had evidence that Linda's blood was at Gurley's apartment. They did not believe that Gurley would have let Dyson into her house under any circumstance. Their theory on what happened that night was that they believed there was an altercation in Gurley's apartment and that Gurley was taken forcibly to another location, probably alive. They believed she was taken out in a tarp or a body bag, and she was driven to the area of Magdalena, New Mexico, where she was tortured by use of the ninja sword and other items, and then killed. Linda did not testify at her own trial, and on October 25, 2002, the jury came back with their verdict. They found Linda Henning guilty of first-degree murder. She was also convicted of kidnapping, conspiracy to kidnap, tampering with evidence, and 4 counts of perjury, but was acquitted of 10 other charges. She was the first woman in New Mexico history to face the death penalty. Linda's sentencing trial began on April 18, 2003. Just prior to her sentencing court date, prosecutor Paul Spears issued a statement in a memorandum that Linda had told at least 4 people that she had eaten Gurley's flesh and drank her blood, stating that, quote, "During the course of the case's investigation, it was reported by more than one individual that the defendant had made statements that she had actually consumed the flesh of Gurley Chu Hasenkopf and that as a consequence, her remains and body would never be recovered by authorities." Allegedly, Linda had also confessed to a cellmate, quoting from Reddit, "Henning's cellmate tells when Henning was asked what she did with Gurley's body, she made eating gestures." Despite this allegation by the state, Linda was not sentenced to death, but was given a 73.5-year prison sentence. After her sentencing, Linda had this to say about it and wanted to give a stern warning to the rest of the world while she had the opportunity to do so.
"I wasn't surprised. If they would have said, well, burn her at the stake, I would have said, well, it wouldn't be the first time. You know, a past life, I believe I was burned at the stake, so."
"I think the whole thing has been a hoax from day one.
Now, I have been painted as the biggest monster, the most dangerous criminal in New Mexico history. Now, you've got to look at my background and say, well, where is it? There must be something that they're afraid that I'm going to say, because they've made every effort possible to silence me. Well, of course, I know what they don't want me to say.
Which is?
Which I'm not going to say. I'm still alive, so it's probably because I've kept my mouth shut. I know you love to talk about that, Ron. Rod, but I will only say that everybody's in for a real big surprise. Mm-hmm. The empire consumes all. The strong survive and the weak perish. That's about everything you need to know."
Her perjury convictions were overturned by the New Mexico Supreme Court in 2010, but all of her other convictions, as well as her sentence, were affirmed. Investigators don't believe that Bill Miller was responsible for Gurley's murder, and he was originally charged with conspiracy to commit murder, kidnapping, and tampering with evidence charges. It's alleged that Bill stalked Gurley to find out where she lived, then assisted in kidnapping her and helping to dispose of bloody evidence and her body. His attorney was able to get the more serious charges dropped, And after he went through trial, Bill received 10 months probation. In January of 2020, 21 years following the disappearance of Girlie Chu, Dyson filed a 400-page document to court requesting that his plea and life sentence be vacated. He claimed that his sentence was illegal, that he was denied due process because of collusion, that his attorneys failed at their jobs, and that he was forced into his plea deal. Dyson claims that prosecutors were colluding with the Albuquerque police to hide evidence that would have exonerated both him and Linda Henning. His attorney asked for a 6-month extension to collect evidence involving global connections.
Now, 18 years later, Hasenkopf is asking a judge to vacate his sentence. Hasenkopf claimed prosecutors were colluding with Albuquerque police to hide evidence that would have exonerated him and his mistress, Linda Henning. Henning is also serving time in prison for the murder. During a hearing in court today, Hasenkopf's attorney asked Judge Alyssa Hart for more time to get his facts organized.
And you absolutely feel that you need 6 months?
I do, Your Honor. This investigation, I don't want to get into too many details, but this case involves global connections.
The request for the 6-month extension was granted. To this day, Girlie Chu Hasenkopf's body has not been found, but authorities believe it's located somewhere in Socorro County, most likely along U.S. Route 60 near Dattle, New Mexico. As bizarre as this case is, it comes down to what is fact and what is fiction. Dyson Hasenkopf's life was full of delusions of grandeur and a sense of entitlement. Linda Henning was so wrapped up in her outlandish beliefs and her admiration for a con man that she was consumed by it, and it became a black hole that she couldn't escape. It's a horrible tragedy that Girlie Chu's family will never really have closure in this case, but hopefully they have found some shred of solace in knowing that the individuals who took Girlie Chu from their lives have been punished to the utmost extent of the law. Thank you for listening. Please check out our website at thecrimeshack.com, where you can find links to all our social media platforms. Be sure to follow us on Instagram, the only platform where I do giveaways for cool stuff. Did you know I'm also on TikTok, where I do mini crime stories? Check out my profile at Shell's Crime Shack. This podcast is currently sponsorless, and as a listener, you can help support the show by purchasing merchandise, joining my Patreon, or just by buying me a coffee. Any support is much appreciated.